House Public Safety Committee is called to order, and we don't quite have a quorum yet, so we won't get to committee business from that standpoint. But we have Representative Szymanski and House File 2409. Representative Szymanski, to your bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning, Representative Szymanski.
All right. Mr. Chairman, would you like me to proceed with testimony?
Please proceed, Representative Szymanski. We don't have a quorum yet to move the bill, but let's go ahead and now we have a quorum. So we're going to do our roll call first, do our committee business, and then we'll get back to you, Representative Szymanski. So, Pete, you want to do the Mr. Sparby? Let's do the roll call.
Chairman Cornish. Vice Chairman Woodard. Representative Mullery. Representative Doubt. Representative Gauthier.
Here.
Representative Grunhagen.
Here.
Representative Hilty. Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Kelly.
Here.
Representative Kiefer.
Here.
Representative Kreisel. Representative Leidiger.
Here.
Representative Mariani. Representative McDonald. Representative Moran.
Here.
Representative Nornes.
Here.
Representative Slocum. Primarily. Representative Smith.
Here.
And Representative Moran, after your review of the minutes, would you be willing to move our minutes for us?
So moved.
All those in favor of, of approving the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The minutes are moved, are approved. Representative Szymanski to House File 2409.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any...
House File 2409 is a bill brought to me by the Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis last year. The bill addresses some very serious concerns about the operation of the Minneapolis Civilian Review Authority, also known as the CRA. Since this bill came to my attention, there have been at least three newspaper articles about the CRA, and in my opinion, the Minneapolis CRA is not working. And in the last 3 years, the CRA has advised the police chief that officers have violated policy, department policy, 129 times. Yet the chief has imposed discipline in only 17 of those cases. The Minneapolis Civilian Review Authority has been given the authority by city ordinance to make findings of fact and determinations with regard to allegations of officer misconduct. Further, the same ordinance does not allow the police chief or the police department to review, investigate, or change those determinations or findings of fact. And even if the chief has evidence that the determination and the findings of fact are wrong, this ordinance and the operation of the Civilian Review Authority violate fundamental due process rights of police officers. Their reputations and careers can be endangered by this. House File 2409 does two things. First, it removes a provision that exempted the Minneapolis Civilian Review Authority from the Uniform Police Officers Discipline Act when the law was passed back in 1992. The exclusion of the Minneapolis Civilian Review Authority from the basic due process rights that all other officers in the state have was wrong when it passed in 1992. It needs to be rectified. Second, the bill addresses concerns about the operation of the Civilian Review Authority. Section 2 prohibits any police civilian review authority from making findings of facts and determinations and from imposing discipline. Section 2 also provides that a civilian review authority can make recommendations regarding officer misconduct, but those recommendations are advisory only. The police chief in any department retains the authority to discipline. This provision is consistent with the St. Paul Police Department's policy and is consistent with the vast majority of police civilian review authorities around the country. The bill is not against having civilian review oversight. Civilian oversight is fine, but we can't have civilian review run over the due process rights of our police officers. With me today is Lieutenant John Delmonico from the Minneapolis Police Officers, the Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis, and is here to offer further testimony on this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Szymanski. And before we move forward, we do need to move the bill. Representative Kelly, would you like to move this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2409 and recommend it pass and put on the agenda register.
Okay. Representative Kelly moves House File 2409 and recommends passage to the General Register. So, Mr. Delmonico, Representative Delmonico, please go ahead. And please state your name for the record for us.
John Delmonico. Mr. Chair, committee, thank you. I'm John Delmonico. I'm the president of the Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis. I represent approximately 850 sworn officers in the city of Minneapolis. And we're asking you today to pass this legislation because we feel it would kind of give us the same due process as the other 8,000 police officers in the state of Minnesota. And we also believe at the end of the day, when allegations of police misconduct have been investigated, that when it's time to determine whether something happened or not, and whether discipline should be imposed or not, should be done by the chief law enforcement officer, regardless of who he or she is. And we believe this would do that.
Hey, thank you for your testimony. And you've got an additional testifier as well?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Jim Michaels. I'm a labor attorney, and one of my clients is the Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis. This bill is of particular interest from a legal standpoint, and I believe it needs to be passed for a couple of points in addition to those that have been mentioned already. No other licensed profession, doctor, nurse, lawyer, engineer, even cosmetologist, are subject to binding determinations by people outside their profession. This bill would correct that as to Minneapolis police officers and protect other police officers throughout the state of Minnesota similarly. Secondly, when a civilian oversight body is authorized to make findings of fact that cannot be reversed, such as presently the case in Minneapolis, the chief has no recourse when he or she disagrees with either the factual findings or the determination on the merits of the allegations. This leaves the chief with a difficult choice of either imposing discipline on an officer when they believe that it's not warranted, or not to impose any discipline at all, leaving a finding of a sustained finding of misconduct on the officer's record. Most commonly, the chief will not impose discipline. This creates legal liability for both the employer and the officer. When you have a series of findings of misconduct with no discipline, that creates a legal argument that has started to arise now in the city of Minneapolis of willful indifference. That's important because it subjects the employer to federal liability beyond the tort statute limitations under Minnesota law. Finally, even advocates of civilian review authorities and best practice commentators throughout the country have concluded, after years in this business, that even when oversight bodies have investigatory and fact-finding powers, such powers should be advisory only. The reason is that one of the fundamental purposes of civilian oversight is to ensure accountability. And accountability runs through an entire organization. When a chief does not have the final authority as to findings and determinations on allegations, the chief actually becomes less accountable for the actions of his or her officers, because in those cases where the chief's hands are tied, they can simply defer and say, I didn't have the authority to do this, I was stuck with the findings of the civilian review. So with those comments, thank you again, and we'll be happy to answer any questions you might have about the bill or the proposed amendment, which we oppose.
Thank you, Mr. Michaels. Representative Johnson, did you have a question for the testifiers?
Just briefly to the testifier, could you say a little bit about what the origin of the exemption was in the first place? Why was Minneapolis exempted from the
Mr. Michaels, go ahead.
From the act?
Mr. Chair, Representative, my understanding is that at the time that the Police Officers Disciplinary Procedures Act, commonly referred to as PODPA, was making its way through the legislature, it was about the same time when the city of Minneapolis was undertaking to create the Civilian Review Authority. We're talking in the time frame of 1990-1991. It's my understanding that there was a compromise made at the time in the political process that would allow the Police Officers' Bill of Rights to proceed so long as that didn't have any negative impact on the creation of the Minneapolis Civilian Review Authority. So it was plain and simple, kind of a compromise. The fact is that over the 20 years that the Civilian Review Authority has been in business, the need to treat how they handle investigations different from investigations of every other police officer throughout the state just is not warranted. There's no need to retain that exemption.
Thank you, Mr. Michaels. Representative Gaultier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. During this time, there were a couple of high-profile cases, I believe, regarding officers. And I'm not a fan of civilian review boards in invoking discipline. But when you have 129 findings and the chief only does 17, what are those findings? What's the most common finding of misconduct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, in most of those cases, the reason that the chief of Minneapolis did not impose discipline was because by the time the Civilian Review Authority had completed its investigation and made a recommendation or made its finding as that the charges should be sustained, it was after the department's own reckoning period or statute of limitations, as it were, had passed. Meaning that, let's say it was 3 years after, by the time this case finally made it to the chief's desk, in minor levels of discipline, language, attitude, these types of things, generally in those types of cases, they're not retained against an officer for more than a year after the incident has occurred. So that's probably 80% of those cases. The remaining cases range from very serious allegations of excessive force, truthfulness, and these types of things, and the disparity results from the police chief not believing that the officer should have had those charges sustained. And again, those are the serious ones that have the most implication, especially we have a recent case in which the Civilian Review Authority has made a determination that the officer was untruthful. The police department's position is that is not the case, that the officer was truthful. If nothing is done, that officer will have a sustained finding of untruthfulness, which raises giglio issues and potentially compromises the prosecution of any case that officer might be involved in. That's another reason why we need to have this change, so that the police chief does have the final authority.
Mr. Chair, just a couple of quick follow-ups.
Okay, Representative Gaultier, go ahead.
Is there conflict between the review board and due process as outlined in the contract between the police union and the city of Minneapolis?
Mr. Michaels, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the conflict really only comes, let me back up. Under the labor agreement, officers have a right to grieve discipline, and that includes oral reprimands following a determination by the Civilian Review Authority. The problem arises in those cases where the chief does not impose discipline, because our right to grieve only is where discipline is imposed.
Okay.
So if there's a sustained finding and no discipline, we have no recourse under the labor agreement.
Okay.
And Representative Gaultier?
And Representative Szymanski, the city of Duluth is looking at formulating a civilian review board. How does this legislation impact that?
Representative Szymanski?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would anticipate that the city of Duluth would be regulated under the same statute as the rest of the state of Minnesota.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Representative Moran?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, can you give me and just help me better understand the history of the Civilian Review Board, and why it was put in place in Minneapolis?
Mr. Michaels?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. In the 80s, there were two or three fairly high-profile cases in the city of Minneapolis where officer conduct was in question. And there had actually been some form of civilian review, although it had never been formalized in the city throughout the 70s and into the 80s. Because of the high-profile nature of some of these cases, I think that there was a feeling that civilian oversight over the police department was a good thing and should be formalized through ordinance in the city of Minneapolis. At the time, the Police Officers Federation did not oppose the creation of the civilian review, and I think it's important to note for all of you that at no time since the inception of the CRA has the Police Federation taken the position that it should be abolished. We welcome civilian review. The key is, however, to make sure that the sworn personnel, namely the chief of police, have the final say over what happens in disciplinary cases. But initially, when the civilian review was created, the first iteration of it involved a hearing process where an investigation was completed, and then a member of the civilian review authority would actually conduct a full evidentiary hearing. And the determinations on the allegations then would be made following that, and then the case would go to the chief of police for the imposition of discipline. At the time, there was a lack of clarity as to whether the chief had the authority to overturn the findings or to disagree with those findings. We've been through three different iterations of the civilian review as the city has, through its ordinances, kind of tweaked the system. The present system has evolved into one in which there is no evidentiary hearing. The case is investigated. The investigative materials are submitted to a three-member panel of the appointed civilian review members, and before they make their final determination, they give an opportunity for the officer and the complainant to come before them and explain certain aspects of the case. But there is no cross-examination or commentary on the evidence. So to call that a hearing is really kind of a misnomer. Really what it is more of an informational meeting. And then the civilian review panel makes its decision, forwards the case on to the chief. And as I said, in 2006, the ordinance was amended to specifically provide that no employee of the police department may change the findings or conduct further investigation regarding the findings of the CRA. That brings us to where we're at today.
Representative Moran.
Thank you for the information. And unfortunately, I don't know the history of Minneapolis, but I do know it's one of the largest urban community, with one of the largest communities of color. And I don't know the disproportionate impact of charges against officers were having on communities. I'm going to assume there was some impact, that disproportionate impact. That excessiveness coming from officers was having on a community of people. That's my thought. I don't know. And I have known my little short stay here in this committee and just seeing the responses from the chief of police that sometimes their agenda can be personal. Sometimes their allegiance is to the other police officers. And sometimes we need a balance of what that looks like or not. In regards to the impact that decisions are having on communities and individuals. And sometimes we need that balance because, there is an allegiance to officers. And so what have you seen going past the 80s, that type of disproportionate impacts of excessive behaviors coming from police officers and charges and community outrages? I mean, what did that look like now?
Mr. Michaels.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I have personally sat on three redesign teams that were created by the mayor and the city council to review the civilian review authority and to make changes to it. I have found it very interesting, as to your point, that many people who have participated in those process from communities of color have also voiced their concern about the effectiveness of the civilian review authority. you can't ever generalize and paint all folks with the same brush, but it's not a universally held position by folks in communities of color that the Civilian Review Authority does a better job than the Chief of Police in imposing discipline. I think if you look at the actual facts, the sustained rate of the Chief of Police on cases investigated by Internal Affairs is more than twice that of the Civilian Review Authority. So at least, and I think Lieutenant Delmonico can speak to this, we've had a number of issues with Chief Dolan. He's been very aggressive in opposing discipline. The cases from that have come to him from the CRA that he has not imposed discipline, I think I've already spoken to as the reasons for that. But the experience also, I think it's important to note, the experience of Minneapolis in terms of having its internal affairs have more than double the sustained rate on cases is actually representative of civilian reviews throughout the nation. So this is not a unique experience here.
Thank you.
Representative Moran?
I think I will hold further questions after I hear people testify.
Okay, seeing no further questions from the committee, is there anyone else in the public who would like to speak in support of this bill?
I would.
Actually, we have one announcement prior to getting to those with concerns on the bill. The ninth grade students from Heritage Christian Academy in Maple Grove. Would you raise your hand so we see where you're at there? Welcome to the committee today.
Hey, is there a Velma Corbell, director of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department? Good morning, ma'am. If you want to state your name and title again and proceed.
Good morning. My name is Velma Corbell, K-O-R-B-E-L, and I am the director of civil rights in the city of Minneapolis. I've been there in that position now for about a year and a half, and prior to my taking the job in the city of Minneapolis, I was the commissioner of human rights for the state of Minnesota, appointed to that position by former Governor Tim Pawlenty, and I was in that position for 7.5 years. I'd like to start by saying that the city of Minneapolis opposes House File 2409, and without having a lot of information on why this bill was drafted and brought to the committee, I try to be a mind reader and anticipate some of the issues and questions that might arise as a result of the bill going forward and the city's opposition to it. As Representative Szymanski mentioned earlier, the Minneapolis Civilian Review Authority was created to handle, in a couple of ways, allegations of police misconduct brought to the agency by individuals within the city of Minneapolis. Currently, the process is carried out by a board that is appointed by the Minneapolis mayor and the Minneapolis City Council, with staff support provided by the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department. The rules which determine the role of the board and staff are codified in the Minneapolis Code of Ordinances. There was some testimony earlier about the fact that somehow there's an inference being drawn that the decisions, the findings of fact, and the determinations made by the Civilian Review Authority in Minneapolis are final. And I would like to just touch on that if I could, please.
Go ahead.
The findings of fact and the determinations of a sustained allegation afforded to the chief law enforcement officer in the city of Minneapolis, who is the Minneapolis chief of police. By ordinance, the chief of police may do one of the following with that forwarded allegation. He can impose discipline and notify the review authority in writing that discipline has been imposed. he can determine that no discipline will be imposed and notify the review authority in writing of such determination and the reasons for such determination. He can make a one-time written request that the review authority reconsider the sustained finding, or he can submit in writing to the review authority a request for an extension of time not to exceed an additional 30 days to take on the actions mentioned above, with the statement for the reason for the extension and the proposed date by which one of the actions will be taken. While a sustained finding from the Civilian Review Authority in Minneapolis come with an expectation that the chief of police will take some action, the fact that he has the ultimate decision to do so clearly negates the assertion that the CRA process is final or absolute. If the CRA makes a finding or determination that information goes into an officer's permanent record and can impact his or her ability to get a job or to do other things in the future, Representative Szymanski and the other testifiers mentioned that is what's happening now. And here's what I would say about that. I would offer that statement or that implication reflects more negatively on the police department, or could reflect negatively on the police department, than on the CRA's finding of facts and determination, because it is inconceivable and does not happen. And it's also discouraging that after years of this process being in place, that there are folks out in the community who would offer the notion that the chief of police would allow a meritless finding of fact to go into an officer's personnel file. If a determination is placed in the file, it is done so after the police department determines that it be so. To imply otherwise attributes much more power and authority to the CRA than it actually possesses. There were some comments also in the testimony that the work that the CRA does would be advisory only. And in order for a good civilian oversight entity to perform in a municipality, there has to be some degree and some authority for that CRA to function well. So whenever I hear generalities that people make that say, no other jurisdiction in the country, no one else does it, everyone else does it, it's always this way, they always do, I immediately have to question the veracity of a statement like that, because there has been work going on for about the past 6 months in the city of Minneapolis that includes work by staff from the Minneapolis Police Department, from the Office of the City Attorney, and from the Civil Rights Department, where those folk have actually been looking at top to bottom at the current Civilian Review Authority process, acknowledging that in the past 15 years there have been challenges with this process, and we want to be respectful and responsive to all of the parties involved in this process. So while we've now acknowledged that those challenges have existed, that staff team has been working to review this process, and oversight and support for the group's effort has been provided by Chief of Police Tim Dolan, City Attorney Susan Siegel, and myself, the Civil Rights Director. The staff has been looking at civilian review models from around the country and right here next door to us in the city of St. Paul. The department heads that I mentioned have liked the process, this new process that the staff group has developed, and we've only recently begun the process to brief the mayor and the city council. We believe this new process will provide greater efficiency, better transparency, more citizen engagement, and is respectful to all the parties in the process. And the reason that we are opposing House File 2409 is that even with this new process, it will require the authority for the review authority to make findings of fact and the determinations. I would talk a bit more in detail about what the new process is. I understand that some of you may have heard some things, sort of feeding around the edges of it, not quite familiar with what it is exactly. I'm happy to answer questions and try to compare the old with the new if you want me to do that. But again, as I said, we've just started to brief the leadership in the city of Minneapolis. The Police Federation, as a matter of fact, was in a meeting a couple of weeks ago with the Chief of Police, Tim Dolan, and they also had a briefing on this new process. And so it's a little bit discouraging that rather than sit down at a table and talk about these issues that have been raised over the last 15 years, it seems to be a little bit preemptive and premature to suggest that the state legislature be the body that would come in and create the process for the city of Minneapolis. So I am happy to answer any questions that I could.
Members, any questions? Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mrs. Corbell. Could you just again for me state what is the authority of the CRA? What is, do they have the authority over the Chief of Police? Is their final recommendation the final recommendation, or what? What is that process like?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the Civilian Review Authority does not have authority over the Minneapolis Chief of Police. Mm-hmm. The authority, it very clearly is given to the Chief of Police through the Minneapolis City Charter. The mayor, of course, is the ultimate executive over the police department in the city, and he delegates responsibility for managing the police department to the Minneapolis Chief of Police. That responsibility nor that authority has ever been delegated to the Civilian Review Authority.
Thank you. Thank you.
Members, who else? Okay, thank you, ma'am. If there's no other questions, we'll move to Chuck Turchik, citizen. Did I pronounce that right? Is there a Chuck here?
Yes.
You could state your name and go ahead.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Chuck Turchik. I'm a citizen of Minneapolis. First, I'd like to say that I'm no apologist for the Minneapolis Civilian Police Review Authority. Director Corbell has a reappointment hearing tomorrow before a city council meeting, committee meeting in Minneapolis, and I'm going to raise some concerns about her relationship to the Minneapolis Civilian Review Authority there. And I'm also in the process, it might be soon, that I might be suing the Minneapolis Civilian Police Review Authority and the Civil Rights Department around a particular case. So I'll no apologies for them. I'd like to mention three specific historical facts. First, in the mid-90s, the Minneapolis Civilian Police Review Authority instituted a system where they surveyed both complainants and officers in all of their cases that went to a hearing. And they were surprised themselves that they found overwhelmingly both the citizen complainants and the officers felt that the process was that they were engaged in with the Civilian Review Authority was a fair process. And this was irrespective of whether the case went for them or against them. A second historical fact, in 2006, the police chief, not the current chief, but the former police chief in the city of Minneapolis, was raising a complaint that the investigations conducted by the Civilian Review Authority investigators were inadequate and incomplete. This is very similar to a charge made by Lieutenant Delmonico as he was quoted in the Minneapolis Star Tribune article last week. In response to that, the city hired an outside consultant to investigate the Civilian Review Authority, and that was a fellow named Kenneth Brown, B-R-O-W-N-E, and he came out with a 170-page report called The Study of the Policy and Process of the Minneapolis Police Civilian Review Authority. And in that report, he noted that he was given 10 cases by the Minneapolis Police Department that they deemed were inadequately investigated, and he was given 7 cases from the Civilian Review Authority where there was no such claim to compare those with. And he found that 71% of those went above the standards of proper investigations, 24% met the standards, and there was one case where he had questions, one out of the 17 cases which he investigated. A third historical fact was that in late 2010, the Civilian Review Authority instituted a process where they were making recommendations for changes in the ordinance that dealt with the Civilian Review Authority. That process lasted for half a year. They solicited comments from the public. They invited members of the public to sit in on the committee meetings, which I did. And after they came up with their committee proposals, they invited comments on their recommended changes in the ordinance. The Minneapolis Police Officers Federation participated in none of those opportunities. A couple of comments specifically on the suggested changes. In Section 1, I don't know why it was that the Minneapolis Civilian Review Authority was excluded at the time of the passage of the 1991 Act by the state legislature. However, all of the processes that are listed in there, I think the Minneapolis Civilian Review Authority could live with. I only noted one that they aren't currently doing, which was in Subdivision 6. They aren't currently providing the police officer with a complete investigative file. And I have recommended to them previously that would only be fair to the officer. The officer should know what the investigator's recommendation is before the officer goes into this informational hearing, as Mr. Michaels described. And I think they could probably live with all 16 of the provisions that are currently in the Act. As for the 17th provision, Subdivision 17, which is Section 2 of the bill, I note in the first sentence that you say that civilian review authorities will not be permitted to make findings of fact, but they will be making recommendations on the merits. How are they to make recommendations on the merits if not to come up with some findings of fact on their own? Secondly, I would point out that the second sentence is a run-on sentence. A civilian review board, commission, or other oversight body may make a recommendation regarding the merits of a complaint. However, the recommendation, that should be complaint, period, however, or complaint, semicolon, however. Putting that, wording it the way it is a run-on sentence. I'm sure the English teachers will tell you that.
We'll work on it.
A final comment. When Mr. Michaels testified that no employee of the police department under the current Minneapolis ordinance may make a further investigation once the case is forwarded to the police department, that is flatly not true. The ordinance says that the police department may not conduct a de novo review of the facts. And the Minneapolis City Attorney's Office has interpreted that phrase, de novo review of the facts, to mean that the police department cannot do an entirely new, from scratch, investigation of the facts. They are permitted to do further investigation. And in fact, they have a Loudermill hearing where the officer is entitled to give mitigating factors that would minimize the alleged misconduct. In conclusion, police citizen incidents are frequently some of the most volatile that we see in society. I might point out that it was police citizen incidents that caused uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt that led to the overthrow of those governments. Now, I'm not saying that if you pass this Subdivision 17 that the Minnesota government is going to be overthrown, but I do believe that you are stepping into a minefield. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, sir. The next one, Michael Calvin.
I'm sorry to the children go because I think they need to hear this. My name is Michael Calvin.
State your name and title and go ahead and begin.
My name is Michael Calvin. I am a registered nurse and live in Minneapolis.
Did you say Calvin or Calvin?
Calvin.
Calvin.
C-A-V-L-A-N. Yeah. And I've worked for a number of years with the group Communities Not Against Police Brutality. Police brutality is a reality and it's an epidemic in both in this state and in this country. It's a reality. In fact, just last week, as a matter of fact, here in Minnesota, there was a 77-year-old gentleman who was in a nursing home, a patient in a nursing home, who was actually tasered by the police, either the police or the sheriffs. I'm not sure which one, but it was one of those law enforcement agencies actually tasered this 77-year-old patient of a nursing home. All right, probably he had Alzheimer's and was acting out. You don't need to tase a 77-year-old man.
That's your opinion, right?
That is my opinion,
okay.
Based upon my professional experience as a nurse, yes. I know how to take down a 77-year-old man if he's acting out. All nurses do. Now, here's the thing. The Civilian Review Authority right now is the only place for citizens to go if they have a problem with the police within the current system. Okay? I'm going to talk about not what we think or what we wish it is, but what really is. I work with CAPB week after week after week. We have at least 2 to 3 people come to our organization each week talking about police brutality. We've also found that internal affairs, our experiences with internal affairs, is that when somebody goes to internal affairs, they are targeted by the police and actually punished by the police in acts of retaliation for complaining about police brutality. That's been our experience. We advise people not to go through internal affairs for that very specific reason. Now, we talk about the need, the police, for the police need to police themselves. We talked about how nurses and doctors and lawyers don't have civilians on their boards. That's actually not true. The nursing board does have civilians on the nursing board. And in fact, further than that, the nursing profession and the medical profession don't have extreme cases of abuse. And when they are, they're actually taken care of. That has not been the case for the police in this state and in this country. We talked earlier about Mayor Ryback being involved in this whole process. 2 years ago, 16-year-old Fong Lee, a young man who was shot by the police and killed, caught on camera with no gun in his hand. Then after the shooting, he was found with a gun at his side, whose last known place of origin was the Minneapolis Police Evidence Locker. I'm not making this up. Later, Mayor Archie Ryback gave the police officer involved in that shooting, Jason Anderson, a Medal of Honor for the shooting. The process is broke, quite frankly. It's broke. And like I say, the Civilian Review Authority right now is the only place within the current system for civilians to go to deal with this issue. Police brutality is a wide and epidemic issue. It is communities of color and poor white folks that are main targets of police brutality in this state and in this country. These are your constituents. That 77-year-old man had family members who know how the police act out. Those people know when they vote. I want you all to remember that. Do not pass this bill. Thank you.
Hold on.
You bet.
You got some questions. Sir, when you say we, a lot of the stuff you said, who are you speaking for?
I'm speaking as a member of Communities United Against Police Brutality.
The what?
Communities United Against Police Brutality.
Okay, not the...
With decades of experience on this issue.
Not the nursing board or whatever.
No,
or the
no.
hospital. Okay,
no.
That's just right. And then Representative Smith had a question for you.
Mr. Chairman of the witness, when a patient of yours or a patient of some other nurse has allegations of mistreatment or misconduct, mm-hmm. do they have a civilian review authority to go to complain?
No, they don't. They can go to the hospital itself. The hospital will find out what the problem is. And if that nurse acts out, and this is the important thing I want you to hear, if that nurse acts out, the nursing board historically does take care of that nurse. That has not been the case for the police board.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Smith.
Of the witness, to my question, you do not have a CRA over you, do you? The answer is no.
Because there's no need for it.
Okay, next. Are you done?
I
think you said you were. All right, any questions? And anybody else to testify for or against the bill? Representative, you know, go to comments or questions now. Representative Moran and then Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a comment, just my opinion and my observation, just looking at my world in the history of large cities and communities of color and the disproportionate impact of police brutality and excessive force on a community of people, that as we look to the city of Minneapolis and this citizen review board being put in place, which probably was most justifiable to have it in place to hold the police chief and in Minneapolis the mayor accountable for excessive use of police against civilians. I would say just the historical impact that we have seen over years and years of police just really taking advantage of communities of color, that this, in my opinion, is something that is needed. There needs to be a balance of accountability for police chiefs when they, too, have an allegiance to their police force and the police department, that civilians and others need to have a place and a voice in, to ensure that we are bringing on a more just system. So for me, I could do nothing more than vote against this bill.
And Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Szymanski, your bill in no way rids the city of Minneapolis of the Citizen Review Board, does it?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Szymanski.
No, sir, it doesn't.
Okay. And then a follow-up, Mr. Chair, and perhaps for Officer Delmonico or the labor attorney, does the Citizen Review Board have professional investigators that does the investigation, or are they citizens doing an investigation?
Officer Delmonico, or?
Well, Mr. Chair, right. Representative, they do have two current full-time okay. investigators that do the investigations for the Civilian Review Authority.
Okay, thank you, Representative Gauthier. And Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where was the referral made to?
General Register, Representative Johnson.
Where was the referral made to, Mr. Chair?
What's that?
Where was the referral made to on this bill? Was it to the floor?
To the General Register.
Or to General Register. Okay. The reason I ask is I think it is really an important issue to talk about and you know, to discuss and look at it from all the points of view. I worry a little bit about the extent to which all the stakeholders have been had a chance to weigh in on this. But so my question for you, Chair Szymanski, is would you be willing to refer to GovOps to let them look at it, and since it is dealing with governmental units and the like, to review the bill from that perspective?
Representative Szymanski.
Mr. Chairman, I would leave that at the purview of the chairman of the Government Operations Committee, whether they need to see this bill or not.
Okay. Any other representative? GovOps has been given the opportunity, but they haven't asked for it. So, any other testimony for or against? You have a short comment?
I do.
Okay, ma'am, take a chair. And could you restate your name and title again?
My name is Velma Corbin. I'm the Director of Civil Rights in the City of Minneapolis. And the question about the investigators, who's doing the investigations in the City of Minneapolis. There are civilian investigators in the Civil Rights Department. One of the qualifications of being a civilian investigator in the Civil Rights Department is that you must at one time have served as a sworn officer. The new process that we have been briefing city leadership on, including the Police Federation, is that the investigations would be conducted jointly by sworn officers in the Internal Affairs Division, in addition to those civilian investigators who at one time in their career were sworn officers as well.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gauthier and then Representative Marion.
Just for clarification, so are investigators from the Civil Rights Division doing these for the Civilian Review Board, or does the Civilian Review Board actually employ these people?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the Civilian Review Authority staff are members of the Civil Rights Department in the City of Minneapolis. And the staff are those trained investigators, and they do conduct investigations.
Representative Mariano.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Corbin?
Yes.
Thank you. So earlier, I think in response to a previous question, or perhaps just your testimony, we were, and I'm struggling with this issue because I'm trying to figure out where the authority lines lie legally here, and that might I believe you shared with us that, of course, you know, the chief of police plays this role in terms of determination of his or her personnel, but that authority comes from the mayor because legally that is authority that rests with the mayor. The mayor then forwards that. What is the line of authority in regards to the Civilian Review Board? relative to the mayor's ultimate. I guess I don't know enough about how that's structured, but I want to see whether or not, in my mind, whether or not we're talking about two entities that either come from different authority lines or share a legal authority line.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mariani, the Civilian Review Authority board members are appointed by the mayor and the city council, and they report up to the mayor and the city council through a chair that's also appointed by the mayor. The responsibility, the ultimate responsibility for discipline, it resides in the chief of police, as is a delegated responsibility from the mayor.
And so, Mr. Chair, Ms. Corbett, you probably said it clearly. I'm kind of thinking out loud here, but it sounds to me like the authority lines the authority itself is an equal authority. In other words, the Civilian Review Board does not have less authority relative to the Chief of Police by virtue of being appointed by the mayor, wherein all authority lies. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mariani, the distinction is that the Civilian Review Authority has no authority to discipline a police officer. That authority resides solely with the chief law enforcement officer in the city, and that's the chief of police. Mm-hmm. And so I suppose if you were to look at a picture of an organization chart on a piece of paper, the Civilian Review Authority would be sort of a dotted line off of the mayor's office. So we've never tried to weigh who has the most authority in terms of overall, but the authority for discipline has always been, and there has been no attempt to address that or subvert that. That's always been with the chief of police.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Corbett, thank you.
Manuel.
That's helpful. And so the current discussions between the department and the civil rights, the Minneapolis Police Department and Civil Rights Department, I take it, are there attempts then to further define that disciplinary authority, or is it just it's understood that disciplinary action shall always rest with the chief of police in the midst of those conversations?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mariani, there has been no discussions about minimizing the chief of police authority to discipline. What the process has been looking for is to create a way to make civilian police oversight more effective, more responsive to the citizens, more responsive to those city departments that are part of this process, the city attorney, the civil rights department, and the police department. But nothing at all would hamper the police chief's ability to have the ultimate say in discipline.
And Mr. Chair, final question then, and Ms. Corbett, in your opinion, because there are these conversations happening, how important is it in your mind for those conversations to go forward, at least currently, without action on the part of the state legislature? How critical is that? How important is that, and how important is that particularly in terms of community ownership or rejection of what may or may not occur?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Representative Corbett. Mariotti, this is the first time in the history of the Civilian Review Authority in the city of Minneapolis that active sworn officers in the police department have been recommended to be a part of the civilian oversight process. I think it's extremely important to allow this process to continue, and I really would enjoy the opportunity of sitting down with all of the parties inside the city and talking about this. But I think it's also important that once the staff has gotten the endorsement of the mayor and the city council, that we bring this to a larger group in the community, because what this really is all about is citizen engagement, because the reason the Civilian Review Authority exists is because the community wanted it.
Thank you, Ms. Corbett. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, we got in the list now. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just have maybe a statement and a question, because originally when I heard the testifier and representative bring this bill, it was my notion that the Citizen Review Board had more power or more of a decision-making in the outcome of a police officer who had been brought before the board or to be investigated. But it seems like what I'm hearing now is that the Citizen Review Board has a couple of were created for a few reasons. And what I see is that, one, to bring another voice or view to the investigation, maybe to give some oversight to the department, and then also to engage the community in the investigation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, if I could respond to that. This police civilian oversight process, as it exists today and as we're proposing that it exists in the future, has never been about having civilians have oversight over the police department. What the role has been is that there would be oversight over the investigation process. You know, I'm not an expert on civilian review authorities, but I've become a student in the last year and a half, and what I have seen with this CRA is that over the years it has been allowed to morph into something that has become a hybrid of an ombudsman and a review committee. And I think the reason it has been experiencing the challenges that it has is because of the way it has morphed. And the new process that we have been talking about has really been about defining clear and precise roles and responsibilities of the civilians in conjunction with the work that the sworn officers, both in internal affairs and the trained staff in CRA, to be able to do those investigations. So we're trying to bring a bit more purity back to the process.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Representative Schumacki, go ahead.
May I ask Mr. Michaels to reply to those questions as well?
Yeah. Mr. Michaels, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I think it's just important to clarify one very crucial piece of information that really gets to the basis for this bill in the first place. There's been a lot of discussion about the disciplinary process. Discipline of any employee, whether it's a police officer or a nurse or anyone, involves under a collective bargaining agreement and under the Public Employee Labor Relations Act, just cause. There are two parts to just cause. One is whether there is just cause to determine that the employee has committed misconduct. The second part is just cause as to the level of discipline. The current civilian review authority does not give the chief of police in the city of Minneapolis the authority to determine just cause as to whether misconduct occurred. The chief is prohibited from changing the findings of the civilian review authority as to that element of just cause. The only impact that the chief can have is on the second piece, whether or not to impose discipline, and if so, the level of discipline. And that is why this bill is needed. Ms. Corbell talked about a proposal that's circulating in the city of Minneapolis. I think it's a misnomer to say that the Police Federation has been involved in this process. The chief of police handed Lieutenant Delmonico a PowerPoint, photocopy of a PowerPoint presentation. We inquired about it. The city attorney's office hasn't had input in this process. We've not been invited to input in this process. The labor relations director for the city of Minneapolis hasn't had input in this process. So it's very premature. The point, however, is that this bill does not limit the ability of the city of Minneapolis or its civil rights department or its civilian review authority to change to meet the needs of citizens or the city or its police officers. The only thing that this bill does, and the reason it is needed, is to maintain that the chief of police has the final authority on both elements of just cause. I do have copies that I'll share with the committee of the relevant sections of the Minneapolis the current ordinance.
Page, and he'll bring them up for inspection here.
This does have the language that we've been talking about this morning.
Okay, and in the meantime, Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Corbell, when I look at this legislation, what I'm concerned with is your influence that you have with the mayor. There's nothing that I see here that really changes that. Are you comfortable that you'll continue to have that kind of direct communication with the mayor, who is ultimately the person responsible? Are you satisfied in that regard?
Mr. Corbell. Mr. Chair, Representative,
you know, that's one of the vagaries of being in a politically appointed job, as well as the chief of police is also in that role, is that it's sometimes it can be driven by personalities, but I'm comfortable with the involvement that I have with the mayor's office. I just happen to be that kind of personality that I would force the issue if I needed to, but I think the process that we have been discussing with full involvement of the city attorney's office, with the chief of police himself and his internal affairs staff, I am convinced that if we allow that to play out, that something good will result. So I'm very comfortable with my interaction with the mayor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've talked a lot about the city of Minneapolis being exempt and whatnot, but my question, and all of you are free to answer, is why in the first place was the city of Minneapolis singled out and exempt and no other city in the state?
State your name and title again.
Sure. Jim Michaels. Mr. Chair, Representative, I did speak to that question earlier in my testimony, that it was a compromise made back in 1991 or 1992 when simultaneously the city of Minneapolis was undertaking the creation of the Civilian Review Authority at the same time, independently I might add, that the legislature was contemplating the adoption of the what's come to be called the Police Officers Bill of Rights, formerly the Police Officer Disciplinary Procedures Act. After my testimony, I had an opportunity, I don't know if he's still there, the director of the MPPOA, Dennis Flaherty, just spoke in my ear, good job, you remembered accurately what happened back in 1990. So that is the impact, that the compromise was made in the legislation to exempt the Civilian Review Authority from the operations of PODPA, in order to make it clear that the bill was not intended to restrict the city from adopting and implementing a civilian review authority.
One point to that, Mr. Chair, just because the city was exempted from that portion of the bill does not mean that the Minneapolis City Ordinance does not contain those provisions. So exempt does not mean missing in action. Exempt means that Minneapolis City Ordinance contains those provisions that would have been included in the ordinance from the early 90s.
Mr. Rice, you state your name and title. And
Mr. Chairman, Brian Rice, Rice, Michaels, and Walther, represent the Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis. I was around in 1992, as was Mr. Flaherty. Mr. Michaels, my partners, used the word compromise. I'm not sure I would go that far. The police officers had been working for a number of years to develop procedural due process for investigations against them and pass a statewide bill, which took a couple years to do. Mr. Flaherty was instrumental in that. And at the same time, there was a parallel track of the Civilian Review Authority being developed in Minneapolis. Quite frankly, it wasn't as much as a compromise, it was an either-or. When the bill got to the Senate Judiciary Committee members said either we're going to exempt the CRA or we're not going to pass the Police Officers Bill of Rights, as we called it at that time. Given that it was early in the development of the CRA and given the imperative for these 8,000, almost 9,000 police officers in the states now to guarantee some procedural due process, the Police Federation of Minneapolis was left with a very difficult choice: either get a bill that was much needed passed to apply statewide or not have the bill passed because of the concern in Minneapolis to develop a CRA process. But I think it would be fair to say that's what's happened in the intervening years with CRA. It's morphed, I think is a word that was used up here, into something quite not imaginable at the time in 1992. And with respect to the point, too, about the importance of Section 1, as long as that exemption remains, the city of Minneapolis is free to either follow those procedures, which for the most part they have, or to not follow them. And that's the trouble, really, and why this bill is here, is there's a number of police officers in Minneapolis who simply do not have the same procedural due process rights that other police officers have, or they could be exposed to that. And they also have a disciplinary system that, where the ordinance Mr. Michaels handed out, that if the CRA have the ability to make findings of facts, make determinations, not in a judicial proceeding, not have confront the witnesses against them, and then potentially be found to have violated department policies, procedures, and it's a very serious matter for these individuals.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gauthier.
I am really struggling because I was determined to vote for this bill when we came in here today, but I'm not sure I want to do that right now. I have some conflicts. I think every officer is entitled to certain rights, so I would agree with that part of the argument. I do remember specific cases about that time where clearly there was excessive force used, and I'll leave it at that. But it sounds like today what we have is an internal spat in the city of Minneapolis, and I'm not so sure that the state legislature should be settling it. It sounds like the Civilian Review Authority understands that it's kind of exceeded where it's supposed to go and it needs to make some changes. And that's where my conflict comes, because I think an officer is entitled to due process, and if accusations are made against an officer of excessive force or brutality, he, you know, there's a lot of question whether or not he or she should be able to confront his accuser in public because of the allegation. And I can tell you, having sit on a federal grand jury resolving around police violations of civil rights, in no way was that witness going to be allowed to be exposed to that officer during those proceedings. So I have a lot of conflict going on. And so at this point, I guess if we're going to vote, Mr. Chair, I'm going to pass on voting.
Representative Mariano.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. along those lines, I actually came into this hearing in the same position you were, Representative Gauthier. And now I'm less certain about what I'm going to do. but Mr. Michaels, it does seem that in light of the questions I had for Ms. Corbell earlier about the current the negotiations that are going on relative to possible restructuring, I believe, of the CRA ordinance, in which local police officers, unless I'm mishearing this, are going to be at that table making that decision. It seems to me that they're in a wiser position to make that decision than I am, sitting here trying to sort out what the history is and why we have two different standards. And I agree with Mr. Rice that we shouldn't have two different standards in the state, but I suspect that there's a story, you know, there that we're not really getting at, and I don't want to go back 20 years to, you know, dig into that. But again, it seems to me that the best people to make that decision at this point, suggesting that perhaps this bill is premature, perhaps not wrong, but perhaps premature, the best people to make the decision are the people of Minneapolis, including our police officers in Minneapolis. And so I guess maybe my quick question to you is, you know, where am I wrong on that? You know, doesn't that make sense to you that your clients, our Minneapolis police officers, are in a position to influence, shape the local ordinance, and wouldn't that be wiser than us trying to do that right now at the state legislature?
Mr. Michaels.
Mr. Chair, Representative. As I mentioned earlier, three different times over the last 20 years, I have sat on a committee commissioned by the City Council and or the Mayor's Office to redesign and review the Civilian Review Authority. The most recent one was in 2006. During that time, that effort resulted in the amendments to the ordinance that this bill is intended to rectify. The city adopted this process by which it prohibited the chief of police from changing findings of the CRA over my objection, over the recommendations of the city attorney's office, over the objections of and the recommendation of the city's labor relations director. I do not believe that this is a matter that will be solved or resolved internally. Secondly, to say that there have been negotiations up to this point is completely a misnomer. As I mentioned, the Federation was not invited to participate in any of the efforts that led up to this, and I have not even seen yet a draft of any amendments to the ordinance. As far as I understand, the only thing that exists right now is a PowerPoint of concepts of what a redesign would look like. I think it is important to have this legislation in place so that the city of Minneapolis will be bound by the same provisions as all other jurisdictions in this state regarding how police officers will be investigated and disciplined. And that's what this bill does. It does not in any way prevent those reviews and redesigns from proceeding. It simply puts Minneapolis officers on the same standing. And the legislature determined in 1992 when it passed PODPA that we want to have a uniform set of standards for police officers in this state. This bill is just in furtherance of the protections from PODPA.
Okay, Representative, were you done? Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think first I should just say that, you know, I really, really respect police officers, and they make a sacrifice to do what they do, to come out and, you know, protect, you know, everyday citizens. They have a huge task in front of them, and I'm sure those who are working in the city of Minneapolis, the task may be even huger than many of the other surrounding states. So I just want to be clear that I truly respect them. It was my first time here that I, you know, came into the awareness that a police officer was called a peace officer, because in my community, you know, we never seen them as peace officers. They were police officers, because the relationships that we have with police officers is not always one of great outcomes or good outcomes or good relationships, because they did most of the time they did not come from the community. They came from out of the community into the community enforcing the law and didn't have those relationships with community members. But I do know the work that they do is very important. And so before me, I hear one of the reasons that you're here at the state with this bill is that you would like the state of Minneapolis, Minneapolis to be in line with all the other states as far as procedures. And I want to believe that one model does not fit all. We have to look at individual communities, individual cities, and say what is best to support the needs of that community. And I would say the city of Minneapolis may not be compatible with many and a lot of other cities. So I truly don't believe that one model fit all. But here we are with Mrs. Corbell here saying that over the last 6 months that they are looking at how they can, how the Civilian Review Board can be more effective, and how they can, how the Civilian Review Board can be more effective, and how they can collaborate and work so that, I guess, to help whatever is not working in the city of Minneapolis be more effective, to create better outcomes, that's so that police officers are getting their due process, but so that investigations are also appropriate, which I believe is a local decision that needs to be made from the state of Minneapolis. What I heard was that the overall authority comes from the mayor, and that's the conversation that the mayor needs to have with all the entities that are in play here. I just think this is overstepping, you know, our authority and not allowing the due process to take place within that city to do what they need to do for this to be more effective, opposed to saying let's just dismantle this really important entity that really involves giving a community and some other stakeholders a voice in charges that has taken places against police officers. So my hope is that we can lead this as a local control, local government issue, and let the mayor and all the stakeholders that he has appointed to do what they need to do so they can create better outcomes and ensure that investigations are transparent, they're fair, and they are achieving good results.
Members, we've got two more bills to do yet. One of them is a lengthy one where we have to add other bills to it. So if we could keep the questions and answers short as possible. Anybody else left? Anybody out there testify for or against? I think I already asked that once. Before we restate the motion to pass this at General Register, just some comments about the person that maligned the police in general. We've got 10,300 active licensed police officers in Minnesota, highly trained, probably better than most states in the nation, and under control more than most states in the nation. And I think they have a very good procedure. Sir, we won't be taking any more testimony. The problem we have here is I think it's scary to leave it to local control for when you're talking about Discipline Procedures Act like this, because we're going to have a hodgepodge of investigative techniques and finding of fact all over the state if we do that. The rules of criminal procedures and courtroom procedures are applied statewide for many other things. I see no need to start a lattice work of laws clear across the state. And my feelings on the bill, this is a good bill and it's needed. I think that the legislature should bring uniformity to investigations and not every department acting on its own volition and coming up with all sorts of investigative techniques. So having said that, I have no doubt, I think everybody agrees that there is a case of two of police brutality, but we've also got nurse molesting patients and we've got ministers molesting altar boys. We got all sorts of evils going out there. I would say that the police officers are probably a standard above with all the investigating they get, and when we uncover it, we do the best we can. So, anybody else? All right. Representative Kelly, you wish to restate the motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would renew my motion, and actually I would make a quick comment. Just as I understand Representative Moran and others saying this is a local, should be a local issue, but clearly when it cannot be decided locally with the history there, sometimes as legislators, as a higher authority, we're asked to step in and do that. And I see this, there's simply the ask here is to treat Minneapolis police officers as every other police officer in the state of Minnesota. I don't think that's a tough decision for us, and I think as leaders we need to vote on this. So I would renew my motion that House File 2409 be passed and sent to the General Register.
Okay, having heard that, without any more comments, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay, so carried. Thank you, Representative Schmitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kelly, House File 2491. And if Representative Kelly, if you'd like to first move your bill, and do you have any amendments?
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you. I would like to move House File 2491, recommended to pass, referred to Judiciary.
Okay. The House File 2491 is before us. Representative Kelly, proceed how you wish.
Mr. Chair, this bill is really a clarifying bill speak to a bill already in statute created in the year 2000. Domestic abuse no contact orders is really it's a criminal order, and we're not changing that. We're simply stating that in the definition, so it relieves some of the ambiguity in statute right now. So that's the first change there. The second is simply stating that a domestic abuse no contact order could be initiated in the same hearing, and Liz Richards here from Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women will also go into detail here, but really what this is doing is clarifying existing language so that we actually create more efficiency in our courts.
Ms. Richards, if you state your name and title, and go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Cornish, members of the committee. I'm Liz Richards. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. Excuse me. The Domestic Abuse No Contact Order, the DANCO, was created in statute in 2000. And the DANCO is widely used in criminal proceedings, criminal domestic abuse cases, to provide protection to domestic violence victims. And this is at a time that is one of the most dangerous and one of the most lethal times in domestic violence cases. In 2010, as part of the Domestic Violence Omnibus Bill, a number of changes were made to the DANCO statute. Those changes included moving it from the family law of 518B into the criminal statute, and as part of the process, the paragraph concerning separate proceedings was added. There were other changes to the DANCO statutes, but those aren't involved in this bill today. But since 2010, there has been much discussion and actually much confusion and concerns about the DANCO statute. And these concerns fall into two categories. One is there are some questions about the constitutionality of the statute, but second, there are also confusion over the process that's set out in the statute. This proposal does not touch those constitutional issues, but rather deals with the procedural questions. Over the summer and the fall, the coalition has convened many different people to look at and to discuss the concerns with the DANCO statute. This has included city attorneys, county attorneys, law professors, legal advocates, and a few judicial officers. This bill is based on the consensus of those people. We're not asking for any changes that would address the constitutional issues because there's no consensus on whether there actually is a constitutional problem with the statute or not. What are those constitutional issues and what a statutory fix would be. So people are looking to the courts to first define and address the constitutional issues. What this bill is looking to do is, and there's consensus on this fact, that because of the confusion in the courts and because the appellate process takes time, that people are looking for these changes to give clarity to the district court as they're dealing with the DANCO right now and waiting for the appellate court decision. And the two changes are simply the insertion of the word criminal to make it clear that the DANCO is a criminal order issued in a criminal proceeding and not a civil order issued in the criminal proceeding, so it's a clarifying piece. The other is the deletion of the separate proceedings paragraph, as it's not necessary in the bill, and it actually leads to a lot of speculation about what was the intention of that language and confusion. Just a few examples. There's questions about if there's a difference between the use of the word proceeding versus hearing. There's confusion about what is meant by separate. Is the DANCO a separate court proceeding and therefore needs a separate filing document or a separate case number? Does the public defender appointment extend to the separate proceeding? Those are just some of the issues that the district court is dealing with because of the language in that paragraph, and it's not necessary. So there's consensus that among those who have participated in these discussions, and it's been a very wide group of people, that these two changes, while they don't address the constitutional issues, they will lend clarity to the statute and be helpful at the district court level.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Richards. Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't really have a question for you. I just want to thank Representative Kelly for bringing this forward.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Do you have anybody else to testify for or against or any amendments? Okay. Representative Kelly, would you like to renew your motion if there's nobody else to testify out there?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion. House File 2491 passed and referred to Judiciary.
Okay, thank you, Representative Kelly. With no other comments, we'll take a vote. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Thank you.
Representative Cornish, you'd like to move your bill?
Yes, I'd like to move House File 2415 be recommended to pass and going to holding over. Oh, that's right. We're going to hold on to this one and have some amendments here when we're finished presenting the bill. Mr. Chair and members, House File 2415 allows the agency to make electronic notification and with the Department of Corrections, right?
Yep.
All right. And that's with the shortest introduction in history here. We'll turn it over to my testifier for lack of time and let her begin to testify, if you would, please.
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to provide a little bit of an overview of the electronic notification information system that we have developed at the Department of
Corrections. If you could just state your name for the record.
I'm sorry, Lydia Newland, Lydianewlin. I'm the Victim Services and Restorative Justice Director at the Minnesota Department of Corrections. Oftentimes in our conversations around corrections and the activities of corrections, for obvious reasons, we talk about how what we do affects offenders. And this is actually an opportunity for me to talk a little bit about how it is that we serve your constituents that are victims of those offenders. Our administration recognizes that everything that we do when it comes to our work with offenders does ultimately at some point affect the victims that are out there as a result of those offenders. The most powerful healing tool for a victim is information, and our new electronic system that we use to notify victims and provide them an opportunity to have input in what we do with the offenders that harm them does just that. It gives them a voice. This law is really just clarifying and getting us up, or this the change in the law is really just clarifying and kind of getting us modernized into where we're at today with allowing victims to request notification, allowing us to be able to provide notification electronically. Victims have a right post-conviction to have information when it comes to what's happening with the offenders that have harmed them. Pretty much everything that happens up to the point of disposition is information is provided to victims without them having to ask. It automatically happens. Once an offender is actually sentenced, most of the notification that goes to victims have to actually ask for. And that's because many victims want to be done at the time of sentencing, don't want the information for a multitude of reasons. So the law, which we have before us right now, is old in that it required victims to have to send a letter or a request in writing to the Commissioner of Corrections to ask to be notified. Prior to Minnesota Choice, it was very paper-driven. Victims sent us a letter. We had to get that letter into a confidential file for the offender, and it was just an old, antiquated process. We partnered with the Department of Public Safety and applied for a Bureau of Justice grant in 2009, and we were awarded a grant to be able to develop our new system. And then we began to incorporate our old request for notification into our new system. And in 2010, we were able to deploy Minnesota Choice. We centralized our process, we reduced our human error, we are able to offer more options for our victims in notification. We don't just now offer them the opportunity to get their notification by U.S. mail. They can request to be notified by email, they can request to be notified by our message center, and so it gives them a choice on how that information that comes to them is actually handled. We've heard from victims who have said that letter that comes in the mail can be very re-traumatizing for them. Many of them really appreciate the opportunity to be able to choose when and how they get that information. We are also able through this process to verify that the information that we have for our victims is accurate. When we began to look at centralizing this and making this an electronic process, what we realized is over 35% of the contact information we had for our victims was inaccurate. Victims move, they forget to let us know where they're living, and it's one of the most disheartening things ever to hear from a victim how upset they were to see the person in the community who harmed them and that they weren't notified, only for us to realize that it was because we didn't have an accurate address for them. So our new electronic process allows us to verify with victims annually that the information we have is accurate and also let them know what new options might be available for them. We are also able, through our electronic process, to do a better job connecting our agents in the community who are supervising our offenders with the victims. Oftentimes, the victims can have a great deal of information that's helpful for those agents in supervising the offenders, as well as keeping the agents involved and connected with our victims is very important from a public safety standpoint and to keep our victims safe. We are also, with Minnesota Choice, one of the big changes that we wanted to make is that for many, many years, we have been providing victims information and by doing so, just giving them information. What we wanted to do with Minnesota Choice was offer them an opportunity to be able to give us information back and to have some feedback and some input, especially as we begin to look at reentry for our offenders. And so with Minnesota Choice, our victims can provide us information at the time of reentry for our offenders that can help us better serve them and also keep them informed and our agents informed of what the concerns might be from a victim. Finally, we wanted to be able to offer victims the opportunity to participate in the restorative justice opportunities that we have at the Department of Corrections. Many times people think that at the time of sentencing, when that gavel goes down and the offender goes to prison, that that is healing justice for our victims. And what we've learned that victims oftentimes have many questions and concerns and want to remain involved after an offender has actually been sentenced. I've had many victims who have come to me and said, I really wanted to know what my daughter's last words were, or I need to know if this offender is really sorry for what they did. We call those restorative justice processes at the DOC. We have a victim-offender dialogue program in place where victims want to meet with their offenders. We have a very safe process in making that happen if it's appropriate. We also have an apology letter process so that our offenders can write letters of apology to victims. Many, many, many calls come to my office where victims say they never said they were sorry, and that's really what I was looking for. And so we wanted to be able to incorporate that into our electronic process as well, and our victims are now able to ask to participate in those processes through our Minnesota Choice program. A couple quick statistics for you here, because I know y'all want to get to lunch. But we are, this last year, we had 1,460 new victims register through Minnesota Choice to be notified of offender status, and we provided over 6,100 notifications to victims throughout the year. Everything from release notification to transfer notification to death, and as well as letting victims know what the conditions of release are for offenders when they're released. We partnered with the Department of Public Safety to ascertain the funds to be able to pay for the implementation of Choice, and we were awarded that grant in fall of 2011. We have since applied for and received an enhancement grant where we will be incorporating restitution into the Minnesota Choice electronic process. So we're able to track and communicate restitution payments that our offenders are paying. We are increasing our enhanced collaboration with prosecutors and victim witness as well as Department of Human Services, and that's what this bill also addresses. We right now want to reduce the frustration for victims who have to ask many times through the system to be notified. They have to ask at the time of sentencing to be notified. They then have to ask the Department of Human Services to be notified if an offender is looking at commitment. And then they have to ask again under our community notification legislation for law enforcement to keep them notified. So what we built into the Minnesota Choice system is an opportunity for victims to ask once, and then we forward that information onto the Department of Human Services and onto our prosecutors so that those victims don't fall through the cracks and not get notified. And that's what this legislation change also addresses. We will also be increasing options for victims to request and participate in safety planning at the time of an offender's release, and adding some video tutorials to the system, as well as the opportunity for victims to Skype when they meet with us and our staff. Some goals that we do have is that we want to increase our electronic notification by 40%. In the first year of our electronic program, we increased our email notification by 25%, which means that we reduced our U.S. mail notification by 75%. That's just good service for your constituents because they're not waiting 4 or 5 days to get information regarding an offender who was released on Thursday, and by the time the mail gets to them, it's Tuesday, and it's kind of after the fact for them. So we're real proud of that. We want to increase our notification request by 25%. I would say that probably 40% of the phone calls and concerns that come into my office have to do with victims who say, I didn't know I had to ask to be notified. We're going to build in some processes here to be able to help that. We want to increase our restorative justice opportunities for victims by 25%. One of the things I'm most proud of is that in this last year, victims who requested to participate in our apology letter process and our victim offender dialogue process increased by 300%. And so we are now able to reach those victims and let them know what's available out there for them after that gavel goes down.
Are there
There'll
any questions? Any questions on House File 2415 or for Ms. Newland?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, if I could offer the DE1 amendment, to put it in the proper form, then I can
Certainly.
Explain it after.
Representative Cornish?
The chair would offer the DE1 amendment to 2415 to get it in the proper shape.
Okay, Chair Cornish moves the DE1 amendment to House File 2415. If you'd like to speak to that amendment.
Yes, this is an agency corrections bill, and what it adds to the bill is, first of all, House File 1938. That was my bill for the authorized the Fugitive Apprehension Unit to apply for search warrants. That passed our committee. The second one would be House File 1958. And was this the Representative Hillstrom's? Which offenders are not eligible to participate in the challenge of the CIP program. It makes changes to that. And another one is House File 1959. It, I believe also Representative Hillstrom's bill eliminates a report that lists and describes the performance measures and targets of the DOC will include in their biennial performance report. So I think those were all bills that went through our committee that will be added on to this. Will be a vehicle bill or a omnibus corrections bill.
Any discussion from the committee on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the DE1 amendment to House File 2415 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carries. And to the bill as amended, Representative Cornish.
Unless there's any questions. I didn't know if we moved it, if we're going to keep it here for where we tend it.
Ways and means.
Okay, so the motion should be to recommend to pass House File 2415 as amended with the DE1 amendment and move to Ways and Means.
Representative Cornish renews his motion to pass House File 2415 as amended and refer it to Ways and Means. Any further discussion on that? Hearing none, all those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Next meeting will be Wednesday, February 29th at 10:15. And I believe we're adjourned. Thank you.